Welcome to the Healthy Skin Show with Jennifer Fugo, where we're flipping everything you've been told about your chronic skin issues upside down and connecting you with alternative solutions your dermatologist never told you about.
Welcome back to episode number 296 of the Healthy Skin Show. In the final episode of this three-part dairy versus plant-based milk conversation, we'll round things out with some points that I didn't get to yet in parts one and part two. I felt it important to also consider more practical matters that directly impact what you might or might not be able to purchase. And what's often missing from the emotional conversation about dairy versus plant-based is a discussion about allergies, which for some is a matter of life or death depending on the severity of the reaction, and whether you can find and actually afford to purchase various dairy options. I've had people write me saying that they've been constantly made to feel bad about still consuming dairy, but due to a variety of allergies and even something like celiac disease, many of the plant-based options were off of the table for them. Plus, I know that most people believe that dairy is inherently bad for the skin, especially if you have skin problems, but I wanted to see what the research actually said about this. So I've got quite an interesting bit of info to share with you on that question. So we've got a lot to cover. So let's kick things off with another factor that we must consider is the accessibility of various different milk options. Some are more readily available than others, depending on where you live, as well as what you can afford not only to purchase, but to potentially make yourself. Prices of milk options greatly vary, meaning that someone of a lower socioeconomic situation may be priced out of regenerative and even plant-based options. Cow's milk tends to be the least expensive by far, being around $4 to $5 per gallon and most readily available, thanks in part to a heavy amount of the U.S. government subsidies set aside for the dairy industry. Now, regenerative cow milk can run upwards of $21 per gallon. It's usually available at food co-ops, farmers markets, and more upscale grocery stores, but definitely not easily found for all. And likely, organic and grass-fed cow's milk is more readily available, but again, still not in every grocery store. Goat's milk costs between $8 to $20 per gallon and can be tricky to find. It's available in some local grocery stores, but not all. Other animal milks like sheep, which can actually be upwards of $40 plus dollars per gallon, and camel, which is $160 per gallon, are even more expensive and tricky to locate due to a variety of factors, like, for example, how camels don't produce nearly as much milk as cows. As for plant-based milk, almond and soy seem to be the most affordable, costing between $5 to $7 per gallon. Rice and cashew cost $8 to $10 per gallon. Coconut is about $8 to $13 per gallon. And oat milk ranges from $10 to $16 per gallon, with hemp coming in at around $16 to $20 per gallon. And as far as availability goes, almond, soy, oat, rice, and coconut milks all seem to be relatively easy to find, with cashew, hemp, and macadamia nut milks being harder to locate and typically available in grocery stores in more affluent areas. Aside from U.S. government subsidies supporting lower cow dairy prices, plant-based products typically cost two times more than cow's milk. The reasons cited include research, recipe development, stability testing, bottling procedures, packaging, and marketing costs. And obviously, unless you have one of these animals, producing dairy yourself isn't that simple. But if you have somebody near you who does, that makes things much easier. But making many of these plant-based milk options is fairly a straightforward process, though I will acknowledge that soy milk is actually very labor-intensive. I will link up some recipe options in the show notes for you to check out. But just remember that the homemade plant-based milks do not have the same shelf life as box products, nor do they contain the same nutrient profile compared to dairy. I was also asked in the process of sharing all of this information to include something on raw dairy, and this topic honestly feels like one that could deserve its own entire episode, as the history of dairy is complex. Since the first statewide pasteurization requirement was passed in Michigan in 1947, the pasteurization argument ultimately gained steam such that the FDA then issued a mandatory pasteurization requirement in 1987. The reasons cited for this shift were to reduce the risk of infection from bacteria such as Campylobacter, Cryptosporidium, E. coli, Listeria, Brucella, and Salmonella. There is also a map of U.S. states based on their laws that allow the sale of raw milk from 2012 to 2019 that I've linked in the show notes. And I've also provided another resource that has the laws of different countries and what they allow regarding the sale of raw milk, because it really does vary greatly depending on where you live. And I've certainly heard from colleagues and listeners who feel that raw dairy was a huge game changer for them, but I do have to acknowledge the difficulty that myself and my associate faced in finding data suggesting a superior nutritional profile or a reduction in allergenicity compared to pasteurized dairy products. There is a lot of conflicting information on this topic, so if you are interested in this further, I'd recommend researching it yourself, especially since its availability may be so limited depending on where you live. I am not an expert in this. I have never actually consumed raw dairy, except perhaps in a raw cheese form. So I'm going to also provide a podcast episode from another podcast that could be helpful to check out if this is something that you're really interested in. Now, one reason that I think having options is so crucial is because of allergies and how everyone uniquely reacts to different foods. And so when we're talking about allergies in this conversation, I mean true IgE allergies to various different foods, including cow's milk, soy, and nuts. Obviously, lactose intolerance can make dairy challenging for others, but it's not as serious of a concern as an allergy, which for some can be life-threatening. And that said, it is possible to have an allergy to pretty much anything, so that's why I think variety in this case can be really helpful. Now, in terms of allergenicity, rice is the least allergenic. Though not super common, it is possible to be allergic to hemp, especially as it shows up in more and more foods. Soy milk would be off the table, obviously, for anyone with a soy allergy, whereas nut allergies can be a bit more complicated since someone could be allergic to all nuts, while others are only allergic to specific nuts. Thus, a nut milk option would really depend on what nuts the individual is specifically allergic to. Now, an allergy to oats is uncommon, but gluten contamination and immune reactivity for those with celiac disease complicates things. It's important to know that oats tend to be highly contaminated with wheat and gluten due to how they are grown and processed. And from my understanding, something called the purity protocol is a safer type of oat, assuming that there is no oat allergy or significant reactivity due to celiac. Now, I did link up some information about what the purity protocol is and how to find products that follow this protocol, because you should be aware that oats labeled gluten-free do not carry the same level of, we'll just say, quote-unquote, safety as purity protocol oats do. And so as I look deeper into this allergy piece, even dairy allergies are rather complicated, as cow's milk allergy isn't the only type of animal milk that one can react to. And though it's not common, it is possible to have an allergy to goat's milk. And then we have the matter of lactose intolerance, which is a digestive issue where your body doesn't produce the lactase enzyme in your GI tract. And as a result, people who lack this enzyme will develop all sorts of GI symptoms to milk that contains lactose. And to help with this, there are a variety of animal options, including lactose-free cow's milk, goat's milk, and camel milk. Goat's milk contains about 1% less lactose when compared to cow's milk, and it also is naturally homogenized due to the smaller fat globulins that it contains. Whereas A2 cow's milk may also be better tolerated, especially if you have an issue with the A1 casein proteins that can trigger similar symptoms to lactose intolerance. Goat's milk actually has a much higher amount of A2 proteins in it. And if you have any allergies, I think, again, this is where having the options is so crucial and important, and they must be factored into your own personal decision of what to add to your diet and what to avoid. So one of the questions that I told you I wanted to tackle in this particular episode was the question around what does the research say in terms of whether dairy is actually bad for skin problems. Dairy is usually on diet lists under the avoid category if the list is focused on some sort of skin issue, and I can think of multiples off the top of my head that explicitly say that dairy is inflammatory. And since we're really into asking questions in this series, I thought it might be interesting and helpful to share what research has to tell us on this matter. And it's important to note that research is constantly evolving, but here's what we know today. So let's start with eczema. Now, if I'm not mistaken, dairy is pretty demonized within the eczema community. Most clients are incredibly confused about whether it's okay for eczema or not. And what the research tells us is that unless you have an IgE allergy to a specific animal's milk, avoiding it may actually not make much difference in your symptoms. And while there seems to be an increase in the chances that someone with an allergy to milk would have eczema, it doesn't necessarily work the other way around. And the cases where this is more present are really in very young children and infants, not generally adults. And of these little kiddos who do have a dairy allergy, 61% of them outgrow it by age 5. Even a Cochrane review from 2008 looking at 9 different randomized control trials on whether there was any benefit to children removing eggs and dairy to help with their eczema was disappointing. It found that results were generally inconclusive and that any results from doing such an elimination were more likely the result of having an existing allergy rather than just having eczema. And thus, the researchers did not recommend eliminating these foods if no allergy was present. And we couldn't locate any studies that conclusively found that dairy actually caused a problem triggering eczema or that it would worsen eczema unless the individual had that pre-existing IgE antibody to that particular dairy protein to begin with. Now, rosacea was also a very mixed bag. The one study we found looking at 1,347 rosacea patients demonstrated that higher dairy intake, so meaning more than 2 cups of dairy per day, could positively impact 2 different types of rosacea, while it didn't have any impact on a third type. And when the National Rosacea Society surveyed 1,066 rosacea warriors about their diet and trying to understand food triggers, only 8% acknowledge dairy as a trigger. And in terms of dandruff or seborrheic dermatitis in dairy, there was absolutely no research on that. As for chronic hives or urticaria, research points towards reactivity due to a milk allergy or fermented dairy exposures. However, the fermented dairy would be high in histamine and thus shouldn't be a surprise that it would potentially be a trigger in the first place. And then we looked at what research exists on psoriasis. And unfortunately, we found that there appears to be no strong research or evidence existing that dairy is indeed a trigger. One paper from 2017 postulates that perhaps it is the arachidonic acid content in dairy that potentially irritates the mucosal lining of the GI tract in psoriasis. But the authors couldn't find any other explanation as to why it would be a trigger. Now, if you've listened to enough episodes of The Healthy Skin Show, you likely have stumbled over the information that there is a significant gut component to psoriasis. So that's something to consider. There might not be entirely off base here. And I'll mention a little bit more about this in a moment. The only other piece of significant information that we could locate was a survey of 1,206 psoriasis patients that demonstrated demonstrated dairy as a trigger in about 6% of respondents. That said, 47.7% of those surveyed said that they noticed their psoriasis improved after removing dairy, though I do have to note it was very unclear if this was the sole dietary elimination or if it was done in tandem with other foods. There also seems to be a slightly more clear-cut answer for why acne and dairy may not be very good friends. Research showed a weak association to an increased odds ratio for acne with the intake of any type of animal-based dairy product, even yogurt. However, the reasons still aren't entirely clear. Most research seems to point toward an impact on insulin and IGF-1 or insulin growth factor 1, which appears to impact androgen bioavailability. And a similar issue was found with hidradenitis suppurativa in that going dairy-free may be beneficial because of that impact on the insulin and insulin growth factor 1. That being said, the quality of research for hidradenitis suppurativa and dairy is not great. While one study did show that 83% of 47 HS patients studied experienced varying degrees of improvement, the details of the actual intervention are unclear. And then we were able to locate a survey done on over 700 HS patients. And of this group, they found a subgroup of 237 individuals who identified HS exacerbating foods or food triggers. Dairy was said to be a trigger for about 50% of this smaller group. However, it is not clear if this was, again, a single elimination or done in conjunction with other food eliminations. So, to sum this all up, there is just no slam dunk case in terms of research confirming that dairy is absolutely bad for skin problems. I really honestly thought that we would have a bunch of damning studies to share with you, but that simply is not the case. Clearly, more research needs to be done, but I also think it's worth adding here that in my private clinic, we often find that clients have a tremendous amount of gut dysfunction, gut microbiome dysbiosis, as well as gut permeability, which you guys know is more commonly known as leaky gut. So one factor in all of this is that perhaps the mess of what's going on in the GI tract increases reactivity to a commonly consumed protein, assuming that no IgE allergy exists, and that perhaps with time, tolerance could be found again, as I and my associate and other practitioners have witnessed clinically for many, though not all, individuals, when the GI system and the body has ultimately been rebalanced. As we come to the end of this three-part series, I want to share some final thoughts. First of all, I still believe that this topic is incredibly complicated and one that I wish there was just a simple answer to. Unfortunately, how I approach consuming dairy is likely going to be different from what you may choose to do. And as I shared in part one of this series, I don't have any allergies that I'm aware of, so that is not a factor that I need to consider. However, I personally feel that the treatment of workers is equally important to how we treat animals and the earth. And I find it frustrating that companies have spent millions of dollars creating an emotional connection between drinking plant-based milk with some sort of idyllic notion of non-harm, when in reality, there is a heck of a lot of harm involved in many of these plant-based milk options. As I've learned more about the options that I was consuming, like cashew milk and oat milk, I became very unnerved by the lack of transparency from many companies producing these products. Their websites are loaded full of pictures of happy people, cute animals, and promises of doing better without any specific mention of how they actually accomplish this. And I'm not willing to simply trust that a company charging $6 or $8 or more for a dairy-free product is truly doing everything it can to prevent harm all throughout its supply chain. So my choices of what is most important to me are to support local farmers, and whenever possible, if they're able to use regenerative methods, awesome. And I want to opt for items that include the fewest ingredients while still allowing for maximum nutrient density, so minimal food fortification. Does that mean that I will never eat anything with oats, almonds, or cashews or rice ever again? No, I certainly enjoy these foods, but because of the issues associated with these plants and the crops and how they're grown, it reinforces not only the idea of eating local foods, but also finding companies that do better and care about harm from the start to the finish of the supply chain. And that said, I recognize that I am in a place of privilege where I can afford to make this choice, whereas others may not have the type of access or the financial means to do so. And again, these are things that you have to factor in. And that's why I told you at the beginning of this conversation, I won't tell you what to do. I think for most people, nutrient density is extremely important, especially when food access and affordability are significant factors. So my recommendation would be to consider your needs, allergies, health concerns, access, financial flexibility, and values about the planet, about how both people and animals are treated, and then make a decision that's best for you. And at any point, you're allowed to change your mind and make a different choice when presented with new information. Because if one thing I'm certain, there's no right choice. But at least you'll know that you've weighed all of the factors to ultimately make the most informed decision for you without guilt, shame, or fear. Now, are there topics and issues that I missed in this series? Absolutely. I didn't even mention in part two about the lawsuits associated with glyphosate causing cancer. There's just so much to this conversation that this entire series could have easily been five times as long. And were all of the topics I shared super sexy and fascinating? Probably not. I get that nutritional content of various milks isn't the most entertaining to talk about. And do you have to agree with me or my approach? No, not at all. You're free to make your own decision without fear or judgment. I wanted to share with you what I've been considering, and I hope that you'll also share with me what you discover along the way. This series is not set in stone. It's about starting a conversation and asking questions about the things we think we know to be true. And all of that could change in time, which I anticipate. Because the truth is complicated, and what we know now may be different a year or two from the present moment. But I think the questions deserve to be asked, especially when it comes to such a controversial topic. So if you've got any questions or thoughts to share about this, and I honestly would love to hear them, or you want to check out the resources and references that I've put together for you, head on over to skinterrupt.com/296 so we can keep the conversation going. And if you know anyone who has been confused or torn about whether dairy is a trigger or good or bad for their skin, make a point to share this series with them. I know for a fact that this has probably been sobering to hear a nutrition professional talk about this topic, which in many regards feels like it's forbidden or verboten because we're all supposed to think one way, but we don't. And I think that's the beauty of having these conversations. And then take a moment to rate and review The Healthy Skin Show on your podcast platform. And don't forget to hit that subscribe button so you can tune in each week for new research, clinical pearls, and personal stories, as well as that inspiration you need on your journey to rebuilding healthy skin. And then let's connect. I'm at Jennifer Fugo over on Instagram. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I look forward to digging deeper with you in the next episode.